State lawmakers acted on a smorgasbord of bills this week, including one allowing online voter registration, one on college affordability, one lifting a ban on building new nuclear power plants. We will talk about the legislation moving through the state capitol and other top stories in state and national politics during this edition of The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will welcome in, as we always do, two guests from different political viewpoints to discuss and debate the top news stories of the week. We'll also talk about the Pope getting involved in presidential politics. We'll talk about the debate over President Obama's intention to nominate someone to the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll also talk some about the president's newly announced trip to Cuba, and much, much more. What else happened in the news this week that you would like to talk about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guests. We have with us in the studio John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
And on the phone, we have Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh, a media columnist for the Fox Valley Scene. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's start with this Day Without Latinos and Immigrants rally that took place at the state capitol yesterday. Madison police now say about 20,000 protesters attended this rally. They were demonstrating a couple of Republican bills, one that would end so-called sanctuary cities and another that would block municipalities from issuing local IDs. Tony Palmieri, let's begin with you. How do you feel about these particular bills that led to these demonstrations?
Well, first of all, the protest was extraordinary, the largest protest in the state capitol since the Act 10 protests. Very massive, very, very passionate, and I thought that the protesters were on very, very solid ground. We've got a legislature that claims it believes in local control, until a locality actually tries to do something, then we don't believe in local control anymore. People might disagree with the sanctuary city idea, but on the other hand, if you believe that a locality should have control over how it forms public policy, it should end there with a locality's right to do that. The ID issue is an important one. I mean, we're talking about immigrants that are working, that are employed, and yet can't open bank accounts, can't maybe get prescriptions because of a lack of an ID. So the city of Milwaukee, responding to a real need, tried to do something about it. And once again, we find out that our state legislature uses local control as a talking point. But when it comes to actually supporting local control, a different reality emerges. So I think it's unfortunate what our state legislature is doing.
What do you think, John Sharpless?
Well, I, too, was very impressed with the size of the rally. It was I was down on the square as it was forming, and there were hundreds of people flowing by, men, women, and children. It was quite impressive. I suspect it won't make a difference because that's just not the constituency that Republicans are interested in appealing to. There is a tension here about local control and the degree to which, remember, in this case, this is about enforcing laws that are on the state and national books. And I do think there is a problem if local authority, it's one thing if a local authority has a law that they wish to enforce that they have developed for their own little area. It's another thing for sub-areas to say, we do not consider ourselves enforcing agents of federal and state law. And that can be awfully arbitrary. I think there's more smoke than fire here. I don't know how many sanctuary cities there are here. Obviously, there's the famous incident in California and San Francisco where the young lady was killed by an immigrant that had been taken out of the country a number of times and had a long criminal record. That was kind of the symbolic point for sanctuary cities. Maybe I missed something, but I don't think there's a similar incident in this state. In the case of Milwaukee issuing IDs, again, I have mixed feelings about this. Do you issue an ID to somebody who clearly is in violation of federal law? I can't speak strongly on it because I am divided.
1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show if you would like to talk about any issue in the news this week. Well, let's talk about some of the bills that are moving through the state legislature, including those sanctuary city bill and the local ID bill. The state assembly has signed off on a Republican bill that would allow Wisconsin voters to register online, but it would also eliminate special registration deputies who help voters register by going door to door and appearing at different events. Democrats are saying that this is going to make it harder to register to vote. Your reaction, Tony Palmieri, to this bill?
Before we get to the specific bills, Joy, I just find it extraordinary that the legislative session is over in February. I think over the last few days, there's been close to 200 bills that they've had voice votes on or some other type of vote. Now, you know, as a general rule, I think that the state is better off when this particular legislature is out of session, and I think we're all safer when they're somewhere else. But it just seems bizarre and a bit absurd that the session would end this early with that many bills that needed, you know, attention. Maybe John can speak to that. I think the system is completely broken if we're approving that many bills over a two-day period when there's 9 months left in the year. And I don't know how many of these bills had to urgently pass at this particular moment.
Well, let's get a quick comment. Do you have any thoughts as to why we had to end the session this week for the state assembly anyway?
You know, that gang doesn't talk to me. I don't understand this either. I don't know how legislative sessions work. I don't know why some of them seem to drag on forever and ever and ever, and while others seem to be rushed at the end. I don't understand it as well. It seems to be that when a session opens, you should have some kind of a calendar of consideration and spread over that session. Each one of the bills should be considered and go back to committee and be modified. Mm-hmm. That's the stuff we learned in civics. I don't understand a rush of bills at the end. I also don't understand these legislative sessions that go all the way into the summer. Nebraska has a law that there's 90 days, and every day after 90 days, they have to pay. There's no per diem. And that means a farmer drives in from North Platte into Lincoln, and he makes sure that everything gets taken care of in 90 days. I kind of favor that.
Yeah. And, Joy, to get back to your question about the registration bill, you know, for county parties in the state, for many years, deputizing people to register voters was a way to get out there and do your grassroots canvassing and get people out. I know on college campuses, that's been a good way for college Democrats, college Republicans, and others to get young people to vote, to deputize a student leader and go out and register people. And this particular legislature, which everything is about a power grab, I mean, they've obviously calculated that Democrats benefit more from being able to deputize people to register voters. So it's just, it's part of the pattern that we've been seeing for a long time now, where they get into office talking about we're going to be laser focused on the economy, and when they actually get there, it's about blatant partisan power grabs. And, I think it's really sad what we're seeing.
And, John, your thoughts on this voter registration bill?
Well, I'm really pleased that they have online registration. I think it's about time. this whole issue of the Republicans suppressing the vote and the Democrats crying out that the little old lady who's voted since Reconstruction has been denied an opportunity to go to the polls for the first time in 100 years. There's some issues that animate me and there's some that don't. I think that what will happen here is that people will adjust to the new system. I didn't think there was anything wrong with having canvassers go out and register people. I personally didn't think so. The Republicans feel that's a way in which people who should not vote or have an opportunity to vote. Is it partisan? Of course it's partisan. But I think we will have a couple of years here, and then people will use online registration. And by the way, you can still register at the polls under this bill. And so there will be an adjustment. It's just like the ID thing. There's some difficulty right when the law is passed, but people will eventually be able to identify themselves at the polls with an ID. I think the problems will be momentary, and we'll adjust to them.
Let's take some calls. We have Claire in Madison with us. Hi, Claire.
Hi, good morning, Joy. Thank you. I'm very, very, very concerned about one sentence in Senate Bill 295 that was started last fall. Then they had a hearing last fall, and then they tabled it. And then it was brought back up this January. They added 14 sentences to it, no new hearing. And here's the kicker. One of the sentences says they will allow electronic voting machines without them being certified by the feds. Now, why would they want to do that? And by the way, that passed this week. Why would they want to sneak in uncertified voting machines? Everybody in the state should be concerned about this.
I'm not familiar with that, but if so, why would... Why do you think the state would want to do that? John Sharpless, any idea?
Claire, I'm going to look into that when I get back to my office. I had no idea that they did that. It would seem to me a Republican who's terribly concerned about voter fraud would be opposed to that. I don't know where that came from. Unless there's somebody giving money to the Republican Party who sells voter machines and he wants to make a little money. I don't understand. I'm going to look into that, Claire. Thank you very much.
Tony?
Thank you, Claire, for bringing that up. I had not heard of that, and I second what John Sharpless said. Anyone, Democrat, Republican, Independent, who's concerned about voter fraud really needs to look closely into these types of issues. And again, it's another example of why are we passing something like this now, when there's so much time left in the year where issues like this could get more of a hearing.
The Assembly also passed a bill this week that would ban county executives from serving concurrently in the legislature. This bill would force Democratic Winnebago County Executive Mark Harris to quit his job if he is elected to the state Senate, and he is running for state Senate. Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald has raised issues with a county executive drawing two salaries from taxpayers. Well, Tony, you're in Winnebago County. Do you think that this bill has any legitimacy, or is it just a way to stop, perhaps, Mark Harris from running for Senate?
This is the 18th Senate District, which I do live in here in Winnebago County, and this was shaping up to be a really great primary between Mr. Harris and John Lemberger, who's a professor of education and has been the president of the Oshkosh Area School District Board of Education here. I think that Mr. Lemberger made a great point in a local paper here. He said that he really doesn't need the Republicans' help to defeat Mr. Harris in a primary. I mean, he also said that this ought to be for the voters to decide. If voters are bothered by Mark Harris or anyone else holding two positions simultaneously, the voters can vote for someone else. And interestingly enough, Bob Ziegelbauer from Manitowoc served in the Assembly as a Republican as a Democrat for 6 years. While he was Manitowoc County executive, but the Republicans never came forward with this type of legislation because Ziegelbauer frequently, if not always, voted with the Republicans, so he was okay. I think Scott Fitzgerald, the leader of the Senate, has openly admitted that this legislation is all about preventing Mark Harris from holding these positions. I find it fascinating that the legislature would pass legislation specifically targeted to keep one person out of the state Senate. I mean, talk about a blatant partisanship. The voters of the 18th Senate District are smart enough to decide on their own whether they want a person to hold two positions. And if they don't, they'll vote for Mr. Lemberger in the primary, or they'll vote for the Republican in the general election if Mr. Harris were to win the primary.
What do you make of this this bill, John Sharpless?
Of course it's partisan, but let me say we have a long tradition in America that you can't hold two offices at once. I am surprised that this is even an issue. You can't be both governor and senator. You're asked, if you win both, you're asked to take a choice. It would seem to me that Mr. Harris, when he makes a judgment about running, should be able to decide which one he wants. You can't have both. There's a conflict of interest. There's not only a conflict of interest, there'll be a conflict of schedules and meetings. And I do support the notion that the public shouldn't be paying two salaries for a public official serving simultaneously in two offices. There is not an American tradition that you get to serve in two. You don't get to be president and mayor of Madison at the same time. You just don't get to do that. You got to take your choice.
John Sharpless is a professor of history at UW-Madison. Tony Palmieri is a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh. They are our two guests for this edition of The Week in Review. We will talk about some other state legislation that is moving through the state legislature. We will also talk about news that is being made on the presidential campaign trail, and we'll welcome your comments on all of the above. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is The Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with John Sharpless and Tony Palmieri today about the top stories in state and national politics. And we are welcoming your input at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Assembly Republicans passed Governor Walker's college affordability package this week, despite Democrats warning that this bill does very little to help students. It would lift the cap on tax-deductible student loan interest. It would create internship coordinators. It would require students annually. It would annually on how much debt that they've accumulated. John Sharpless, you're an educator. How much help do you think these proposals are going to be for college students?
They'll be useful. They're not going to fundamentally challenge the problem we face in higher education, that our young people are going into serious debt before they launch into their productive lives. It's helpful. I don't think it should be cast aside as trivial, but I think what really needs to be done is we need to deal with the problem that generates debt, rather than trying to help students manage that debt.
And, Tony, you're an educator, too. What do you think of these ideas?
They're just woefully inadequate. I mean, the linchpin of these reforms are the tax-deductible student loan interest, lifting the cap on that. But apparently, that's only going to benefit about 4% of debtors. So it's woefully inadequate. There really has to be, at the federal level, some kind of loan refinancing legislation. And for people listening, you've really got to look into the Hillary Clinton or the Bernie Sanders campaigns if you really want to be serious about this issue. I don't hear the Republican presidential candidates talking about this issue as seriously. So, I appreciate the governor trying to do something. And college administrators in the UW, I think, are in unison that anything will help. But this is just really, really inadequate for the scale of the problem that we're facing.
Yeah. Just kind of moving along, as there are a lot of bills, we'll kind of do a lightning round here. The state Senate passed a bill that would lift Wisconsin's ban on new nuclear power plants. Currently, state regulators can't approve new nuclear power plants unless a federal facility for storing waste exists, and such a plant does not burden ratepayers. The Senate approved this bill, sending it to Governor Walker for signing. So lifting the moratorium on building new nuclear power plants in Wisconsin, Tony Palmieri, any problems with that?
There's no support at the grassroots level in any community in the state for a nuclear power plant. If anything, they should be moving forward on solar and wind and other alternative energies where we don't have the same issues with waste and things of that nature. So I don't expect that we're going to be seeing any nuclear power plants built in the next few years.
John?
I don't think the industry is going to show up in droves to propose plants here. The industry is struggling in a variety of ways. Right now in Europe, there are atomic energy plants that are very modern. They are extraordinarily efficient. They're site storage. There's been a lot of innovation in the industry, but very little of that seems to have found traction in America. I think this is a symbolic act. It is a source of clean energy, but it carries with it extraordinary risks, and Americans clearly are uncomfortable with the option.
Yeah. The future of a bill that would boost compensation for the wrongly convicted is now uncertain. A bill that would provide the wrongly convicted, falsely imprisoned of inmates up to $50,000 per year for each year spent behind bars wrongly. Passed in the Assembly, but it's drawing flack in the state Senate. The Senate put off a vote on this conviction compensation bill. John Sharpless, should the wrongly convicted get more money?
I don't know what they get now, so I don't know how to judge this.
I think it was $5,000 a year.
$5,000 a year?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we collectively make a mistake, we need to be called to task. It's not a trivial matter to lock up a man or a woman in violation of their basic civil rights and leave them there. And then after we discover our mistake, "I'm sorry" is not good enough. It just is not good enough for having so terribly damaged somebody's life. Actually, finding a dollar amount is difficult, but it should be considerable. Being robbed of those really important years of your life. And then there's always the damage that's done to reputation as well. Even if you're freed, you're always a person who, in the minds of many people, had been convicted, even though the conviction's reversed. So I don't know what the dollar amount should be.
And, Tony, what do you think?
This legislature is fascinating. Bills that you would think would be a slam dunk with little opposition don't get passed, and things that could afford another few weeks or months of discussion get passed on voice vote is just extraordinary. I mean, obviously, what people exonerated of crimes have been paid has been just very paltry and very minimal, and I don't know the figure. I think it was like $1 million or something like that. It's reasonable compared to what almost every other state is doing. I can't imagine why this has been bottled up. I mean, maybe there's just not enough campaign contributions that would come from future free convicts.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Tony Palmieri and John Sharpless. This is The Week in Review. Staying with corrections for a moment, Wisconsin Department of Corrections Secretary Ed Wall has resigned amid an investigation into allegations of abuse at the state's youth prison at Lincoln Hills. Governor Walker announced a replacement last Friday. The same day, news emerged that a Racine County judge had sent a letter 4 years ago warning Governor Walker of possible criminal misconduct at Lincoln Hills. The governor says he didn't see that letter. What do you make of this, John Sharpless?
I am glad he quit. He's the person in charge of a system which is badly broken. If a judge sent a letter to the governor warning him of this serious problem in our state, and he did not see it. It says serious things about his staff. It would seem to me a letter from a judge to the governor should be handed to the governor personally by the staff member. The notion that it was sent off to corrections, it's just ludicrous. If this had been a Democrat, Republicans would be screaming to high heaven.
Tony Palmieri.
I agree with everything that John said, and I will add that I really think that when the Democrats say that this is all about Act 10, they're really, really onto something here. I mean, there's been a 21% increase in overtime at the correction facilities since 2013. It's high burnout field. The collective bargaining rules have been so narrowed and limited that work conditions can't be negotiated in a way that might prevent these types of things. I find it extraordinary that the governor would not have seen this letter. So I would like to see more legislative involvement that's just not political grandstanding, but really tries to get at the root of what are we doing public policy-wise that has made this problem so atrocious since 2010. It keeps coming back to Act 10, and I think that needs to take some priority to discover what that connection is.
Voters in the Wisconsin Supreme Court primary on Tuesday narrowed the three-way race to two, and sitting Justice Rebecca Bradley and Appeals Court Judge Joanne Kloppenburg will advance to the spring election. A third candidate, Joe Donald from Milwaukee County, will not. What do you make of this matchup? Tony Palmieri first.
Well, Judge Kloppenburg had run before, I believe it was in 2011, and it was widely seen as a referendum on Act 10. She narrowly lost that race. The disputed votes coming in Waukesha really is what swung the election against her. Judge Bradley, I think, has been appointed by Scott Walker to three different judicial positions in 3 years. So I do think, once again, that this is going to be a referendum on the governor. It's obviously going to be a very, very close close race. I'm going to predict that Kloppenburg will prevail this time, but of course anything can happen.
Interesting. Yeah, Bradley only defeated Kloppenburg by 9,000 votes, maybe closer than some might have thought. What are your thoughts, John Sharpless?
I think it's going to be a very competitive race. And I think it's a shame, frankly, that this is this race is being contaminated by the long shadow of our good governor, Mr. Walker. I would be interested in the judicial philosophies of these two very competent judges in hearing from them and having it being decided on their merits and the quality of their judicial thinking. I do think it's going to be a referendum on Walker, which is unfortunate.
You know, this was the first test of voter ID. Well, maybe not the first one, but our voter ID law had not been, active until this spring primary, the first one in a long time. Voters, there were few major problems amid the light turnout. Any thoughts on the voter ID law, Tony Palmieri?
Well, I think people need to be aware that the larger the vote turnout is, it's going to take longer and longer to vote. I mean, I actively encourage people to think about voting absentee this year because, especially in November during the presidential election year, where we usually have our highest voter turnout, the voter ID is going to really slow things down. And I don't know what the turnout was on Tuesday. I know it was very, very, very low, so it really wasn't a good test case of voter ID. And I know on college campuses there is confusion as to what kind of ID would be suitable to vote. So I know many of the campuses, including ours at UW Oshkosh, we're going to try and get some workshops going so that people at least know what they have to have ready to vote. This is all unfortunate. Wisconsin went from being the easiest state in the nation to vote, and now it's become one of the more complex. That's really extraordinary and unfortunate.
So, John, do you think this photo ID law is going to be good or bad for Wisconsin?
Well, I don't know if it's good or bad, but I think Tony's hit on something. Just the mechanical process of asking each person to produce an ID is going to add one step in getting to that voting machine. And I will be surprised if there aren't substantial delays in the fall, particularly if we have a high turnout election. It's sort of like a crowded interstate. And the way in which cars slow down, even though there's no reason to slow down, I think it's going to be a problem. It might be something that could be resolved with technology. It might be that at some point we need to have scanners there, and you just pass IDs under scanners as you enter. But I do think the numbers of people will affect how efficient this process goes. Again, this is an issue which I just find I can't get really urgent about it. I think it's adding an inconvenience, but I think we'll learn how to live with it. Can I tell a little story on this? Are we in a hurry?
No, go ahead.
After I lost against Tammy Baldwin by a very small percentage, I got a phone call from a wonderful elderly woman who's one of the old guard in the Republican Party. And she revealed to me that the reason I had lost is that people slipped down from Canada to vote for Tammy.
Oh, don't you hate it when that happens?
I asked her, why would they go to all that trouble? And she goes, they're trying to force socialized medicine on us.
Uh-huh.
I just found the whole thought of somebody driving down to from Canada to vote in the second district was just, it's wonderful. Bless you. It's a long drive just to tip an election in favor of my opponent.
Let's move on. We probably should move on to some national issues now. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we will talk about the debate over President Obama nominating someone to replace the late Justice Antonin Scalia. We'll talk about other developments in the on the presidential campaign trail. Lots of fighting going on there, including between Donald Trump and the Pope. What's that all about? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Week in Review on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Friday Week in Review. I'm Joy Cardine, talking today with Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW Oshkosh, and John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW Madison, talking about the top issues in state and national politics. Welcoming your input too at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Well, let's talk about the death of Antonin Scalia. Justice Antonin Scalia died at the age of 79 last weekend. And right away, a debate started over whether or not President Obama should even nominate someone to replace him. Republicans say that he's in his last year of his last term, and that decision should be made by the next president, not Obama. What do you say to that? John Sharpless, you're a history professor. Do presidents not nominate Supreme Court justices if they're in their final year of their term?
No. That's the text, I hate to sound like Scalia here, the text of the Constitution is clear on this. President Obama, I'm going to sound like a really conservative. He has apparently, if you read it one way, an obligation, at the very least a right to nominate somebody. And bless the Republicans, they can fight that. There's a tradition of fighting nominations. Remember, Bork didn't get the nomination in the Reagan administration. And if the Republicans want to fight him, that's something the Senate can do, and there's a long history of that. But it says that the Constitution makes it quite clear that the president has an obligation to propose somebody. They can stall. Can I comment a little further on that? I think this is an enormous gamble for Republicans. I'm sure there are some poker players out there, and one of the things you probably should never do is try a three-card draw on an inside straight. They are betting that they're going to win the White House and the Senate. That's a long shot. They could win the White House and lose the Senate. They could lose the White House and the Senate. So this is really a long shot. They may want to look at the candidate. And if I were Obama, I would give them a candidate that they've already approved. And so then they have to explain to the public why that person wasn't suitable for the appellate court, and suddenly they're not suitable for the Supreme Court. I'm sure he might be tempted to propose some politician within the Democratic Party, somebody who's very strident and resistant to Republican politics. But the shrewd thing to do is to test those Republicans and say, you already voted this person through. Why don't you do it again?
Tony?
I think John Sharpless is really, you know, very eloquently stated the risk of this strategy for the Republicans. I mean, where I think they're coming from on this is, you know, Anthony Kennedy is not a very reliable conservative vote on that court, and they clearly don't want Scalia to be replaced by someone who might be someone like Kennedy or Elena Kagan, you know, someone that's a recognized moderate. So they're calculating that, as John says, they'll win the presidency, they'll keep the Senate, and then they can get a Scalia or, you know, someone like Judge Alito on that court. I think it's a very dangerous strategy. You know, having said that, I think obviously Barack Obama has to appoint someone to the seat. It's, I believe it is his obligation, his responsibility to do that. But I'm hoping he doesn't give them someone that they'll approve. I mean, he should appoint someone that, you know, he believes would be the best person for the job. I mean, I think too often, especially Democrats when they're in power, think of these issues in terms of who will the Republicans approve rather than who is the best person for that job. I mean, they're not always the same two questions. You know, I don't expect the Republicans are going to approve a justice before the election, which is going to have consequences. I mean, if they approve no one, that seat could be vacant for as much as 18 months, and that could have tremendous ramifications for the cases that come before the court, especially with a court that is as divided as this one. It makes the opinions of the federal appeals court all that more important, because if we end up with 4-4 decisions in the Supreme Court, whatever the federal appeals court decided is what sticks.
Yeah. I'm not going to take the call just because we're running short on time, but somebody is concerned that no autopsy was performed on Antonin Scalia, and I'm seeing various blogs that there's a conspiracy theory out there that...
I knew that was going to happen. I'm a little surprised that there wasn't a little more procedural. There was an informality about this that was really quite charming. It was sort of like the 19th century. They walk in and, yep, he's dead, and then they, you know, and there's really nobody around. There's no federal marshals. There's no Secret Service, you know, and they put him in a coffin, and, you know, it's sort of like, I sort of expected to hear that, you know, those 19th century, the movies about 19th, they put a mirror in front of his face to see if it heats up. Of course, there's going to be conspiracy theories. I'm not sure who has conspired here. This place is pretty isolated. I can't imagine that a rabid Democrat got him.
Tony, did you want to say something?
Well, I'm not interested in the conspiracies, but I do think that there are some serious questions about things like when Supreme Court judges go on these types of trips, who's paying for them, who's there. Justice Scalia, rest in peace, was always very defensive about any suggestion that he should recuse himself from cases because he'd been on outings with people that were parties to the case. I mean, the best example was when he participated in a decision dealing with Dick Cheney and Halliburton, and Scalia and Cheney were very close friends. And I remember Scalia wrote something like a 20-page memo very angry and very defensive about how he should be able to participate. So I do think there are serious questions about where the judges take their vacations, who pays for it, who's there, and what should that mean for recusal later on. I think it's too close to Judge Scalia's death at this point to discuss those, but I think that's more serious than the conspiracy about his death.
We will move on now to some other issues. The White House announced this week that President Obama's trip to Cuba next month will include a meeting with dissidents and President Raul Castro, but is unlikely to visit former President Fidel Castro. Some of the Republicans, including Republican presidential candidates Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, are saying Obama should not be going to Cuba at all, especially with a Castro in charge. Tony, what does Obama's upcoming Cuba trip mean?
First of all, I think it's about 40 years overdue. When President Nixon opened the door to China in the early 70s, that would have been a good time to open the door to Cuba. I mean, we can open the door to a communist country, China, but one 90 miles away, we waited all these years. I think the Cuban exile community, which has been very, very powerful, especially with the Republicans, but also with Democrats, I mean, that community in Miami is not as powerful as it once was. And I think that this is a very, very, very good thing. I think that Americans are going to enjoy being able to visit Cuba without having to go through complex bureaucratic hurdles, or go to Canada or Mexico first just to get there, and I expect that this is going to be very, very good for both countries. It will have a positive economic impact on both countries, and I really do applaud President Obama for showing this leadership. I think this will be a very strong part of his legacy.
What do you think, John Sharpless?
I think the parallel to Nixon visiting China is very important here. I think we have established relationships with nations with poor human rights records, and the argument has always been that by establishing relationships, it gives us leverage through trade and diplomacy to ease that kind of oppression that were going on in that country. We took a different tack with Cuba, and it clearly didn't work. I do understand Rubio making the perfunctory remark about you shouldn't visit a dictatorship. He still has to acknowledge a very important community in his life, less so with Cruz. He's not attached to that. Remember, he's a anchor baby. He's a Canadian.
That's right.
But There's the old guard in Miami and in Florida that still feel very strongly about Fidel Castro and the oppression in Cuba. They still feel very strongly about that. And I would have been shocked if Rubio hadn't given them a nod. But should this happen, of course it should happen. And I hope that Obama will use it to highlight the fact that that regime still is seriously abusing people's civil liberties at the present time.
Well, here's an interesting one. Donald Trump and the Pope are having a war of words, but Trump is softening his tone after this feud with Pope Francis. Trump attacked the pontiff after the Pope said Trump's plan to build a wall along the Mexican border is unchristian. Trump said the Pope should not be questioning his faith, calling it disgraceful. Then later, Trump said that he doesn't like fighting with the Pope and thought that the Pope likely only heard the Mexican version of the story about the wall. Tony, I really abbreviated this feud, but what do you make of the debate between the Donald and the Pope?
I think this is really fascinating because usually when the Catholic hierarchy questions a politician's Christianity, it's usually over personal morality issues like abortion, let's say. This particular Pope is a broad social justice leader, and his message yesterday I thought was outstanding, that Christianity is about building bridges and not building walls, and that you cannot really call yourself a Christian if you're about walling off your country. The response from Trump was predictable, and it was typical Trump style, complete disdain for for any criticism. I think other Republicans chimed in with equally distasteful comments. But I do think it's time for leaders in the Republican Party to stand up and say, let's let go of this really impractical, immoral vision of walling off America. I think that John Kasich is really the only one who seems to have any guts in that primary to make statements like that. So I applaud the Pope for his comments. Sadly, I think that Trump will probably end up getting more support for it in South Carolina and some other states.
What's your reaction, John, to this fight?
I'm sure that Trump hates this moment. There's a sizable Republican voting bloc of conservative Catholics, and you do not criticize the Pope on their watch. And I'm sure what happened with the Pope is that he was set up on this comment. He's not a politician. He was speaking as a religious leader. If you read what he said that you should be not building walls, you should be building bridges, which is a wonderful way of saying you reach out to people in moments of conflict. And it's an appropriate thing for a Pope to say. This notion, then you get layer upon layer on this, the notion that foreign dignitaries and leaders shouldn't comment on our election, and then you have to look back to Netanyahu, who came to America and literally endorsed Romney, and the Republicans embraced that. I am sure Trump is going to try to get away from this as quickly as possible. The Catholic conservatives are a very important part of the Republican coalition, and he has to placate them if he plans to be the presidential candidate.
You know, very briefly, Trump is also in the news this week for threatening to sue a fellow GOP candidate, Ted Cruz, over an ad that Cruz has been running featuring a clip from 1999 in which Trump tells Tim Russert that he is pro-choice. Cruz says such a lawsuit is frivolous and said go ahead and do it. John, who's in the right here, Trump or Cruz?
Trump will lose. All the litigation says if you're a public figure, you can pretty much say anything you want about them, and they can't do a thing. All this is a clip from the past. This is Trump saying things that Trump always... He's always shooting his mouth off, and he has to be held responsible. Bless him. Cruz was right when he said, go ahead, sue me. I'd love to see you in court. Trump doesn't have a leg to stand on in this litigation. Nothing. No how. This is just Trump bluster.
You know, President Obama this week said that Donald Trump will not be president. Do you think so, Tony?
I'm still saying that I will be surprised if Trump becomes the Republican nominee, that I want to believe that at some point when we get to states outside of Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, that the broader Republican base will put someone else in that front position. Having said that, I'm not convinced that Trump is worse than, say, Ted Cruz. That's just me speaking personally. But I do agree with the president that at some point the American people will realize what they're getting here. And I cannot see Trump defeating Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders in a general election. I just can't see that personally.
We'll give you the final minute on where we're headed with the presidential race.
I've been wrong with Trump so many times on this thing. Who knows? Maybe he could be the presidential candidate. I think he's a third-party candidate inside the Republican Party, and that's what he really is. He's actually overlaps both the party and on a group of people who are independents who are siding with him. He's literally a third-party candidate within the Republican Party.
Well, and maybe he will be. So we'll talk again another time about that. Thanks very much to both of you for being with us. John Sharpless, a professor of history at UW-Madison, and Tony Palmieri, a communications professor at UW-Oshkosh. Thanks to Bill Martins and to Niaja Ellison for producing this program. Thanks to Elizabeth Deliquis, who has been helping us for months now. We thank you so much, Elizabeth. This is the Ideas Network.